Johannes Brahms came of age as an artist in the 1850s. During those same years, the performance of chamber music started to regain some of its former significance in Vienna. Between the death of Ignaz Schuppansich, whose string quartet had premiered the music of Beethoven and Schubert, and the formation of the Helmsberger Quartet toward the end of the 1840s, no string quartet had performed publicly on a regular basis in Vienna, as hard as that might be to imagine. By the time Brahms entered the city in 1862, its musical life had begun to develop along lines more congenial to his tastes. Viennese audiences had started to appreciate the late string quartets of Beethoven and to discover the beauties of Schubert's chamber music, just as Brahms himself had during the previous decades. The Helmsberger Quartet had programmed late Beethoven since its first series of concerts in 1849-1850, and already in its second season played two as yet unpublished masterpieces by Schubert. To introduce himself to the Viennese world, Brahms collaborated with members of the Helmsberger Quartet in his own G minor piano quartet, Opus 25. And 2 weeks later, the A major piano quartet, Opus 26. And he continued to take part in public performances of his chamber music throughout his career. To Brahms' contemporaries, his true strength as a composer lay in chamber style, directed at the connoisseur, and therefore couched in subtleties. Chamber music was considered the vehicle for the most rarefied realizations of music as discourse, as sounding discourse, a concept long invoked to explain and justify the instrumental genres in general. Early on, Brahms mastered the counterpoint, phrase rhythms, and thematic motivic work that, to acculturated listeners, made a tonal composition sound coherent. Margaret Notley there writing of the exquisite nature of the conversation Brahms created between and among the players in his chamber music, works like his piano quartets. As it happens, those pieces inspired active conversation, serious dialogue, between Hungarian composer Zoltán Kodály and his teacher Hans Kössler. Kössler was concerned about Kodály's tendency to draw on the Hungarian folk tradition, asking whether such works can be considered high art in the way that Brahms' pieces were. Kodály remembers, even at the beginning of this century, no one believed that Hungarian folk music was suited to higher art forms. It was in those days that Hans Kössler at the Academy of Music, seeing my efforts to compose several movement works in Hungarian style, declared that a little Hungarian spice would be plenty in the last movement, as Brahms had done in the G minor piano quartet here. For Kössler believed that the Hungarian manner could only be present in moderation in high musical art, as dabs of color here and there. It's impossible to talk in dialects all evening, he said. What he expected essentially was something like writing a Hungarian play in a foreign language and seasoning it with a few Hungarian curses. Anna Dolos suggests Kodály's words seem to imply an eagerness to dispute his teacher's view, even decades later. Combining Hungarian stylistic touches to just one movement, as Kössler instructs, does disrupt the Hungarian stylistic homogeneity. In the Brahms piano quartet, though, the Hungarian character in the fourth movement has a dramatic purpose, according to Dalos. A few pages earlier, Kalbeck himself points out how deeply Brahms had been affected by a meeting with Hungarian exiles from the 1849 War of Independence and by their music. so that he used such stylistic traits in his own pieces as symbols of freedom. And again, that from the study Zoltan Kodály's World by Anna Dolos. We're about to have a conversation with co-founders of the Northeastern Pennsylvania Chamber Music Society, violinist John Vida and violist Amy Iwazumi, and we'll talk with them about the upcoming concerts that will feature the second piano quartet of Brahms and an intermezzo by Kodály, influenced by real Hungarian folk tunes. Also on the program, a fantasy by Frank Bridge. We begin with some history from Amy.
The Northeastern Pennsylvania Chamber Music Society was founded in 2015, and so this is our 10th anniversary season, and our mission is to foster the growth and awareness of chamber music in Northeastern PA. And by presenting concerts and having educational outreach programs, we strive to share the love of chamber music with everybody.
And I think more than that, just building community as well around the arts and around music. You know, as I said, we both do a lot of traveling because of performing, which is great, and I love that. But there's nothing quite like coming back home too. And it makes you, I think, appreciate what we do have here. And so, you know, every time I do go abroad or I go to another state, right, it just reminds me of what we've been trying to build for the past 10 years here. And it's funny, when we first started, we were very fortunate to have a lawyer set up the nonprofit for us, you know, pro bono. But he did say to us, you know, just be aware that most nonprofits last 2 or 3 years and don't expect much. And we took that as a charge, actually, to make sure that we prevail. And so 10 years later, we're still going strong and thriving.
And growing in terms of the educational efforts that you've been making, and you brought students to Bengo Dental, and we had a chance to hear them play Mozart, and it was thrilling to know how excited they were about being part of what you all are doing. So that's, as you mentioned at the start, Amy, part of what you do. And so is there another effort underway this new year, 2025-2026?
Yes, we're in our second year of the Young Apprentice Program, and so we've taken a handful of students to mentor throughout the course of the season. And, it, you know, addition to that program, we also make a point to go to area schools. For our first concert this season, we went up to Susquehanna County, and we had a wonderful experience with the middle school students there. I was surprised we played a little bit, but we talked a lot, and actually they kept asking questions after question. I had to stop them up and say, you know what, we don't have time to questions the entire hour, but
there were very thoughtful questions too.
They were.
Yeah, very unexpected questions.
You know, sometimes actually, Erica, you throw us for a loop with some questions, but these kids really, I think, put us, because it's fun to just talk to them, because you don't know where they're coming from. You know, most of these kids, I think, had never experienced classical music live, certainly chamber music. So they just have a different perspective. And so it was really refreshing to get that from them.
Did they want to know about your instruments? Was that part of it?
Yeah, I think there was an instrument question.
There was a couple of instrument questions. One of them was, how many instruments have you had or do you have?
Yeah.
No one had ever asked me that, and I had to think about that one.
And you said, too, as you were sitting down at the table, that this summer you visited libraries in the region as well?
Yes, we started the summer library series, and we thought, well, why not? You can still give concerts in the summer. And the library is obviously a quiet place, but after hours, you can have a concert, and it's a very intimate space. It's a wonderful space, actually. The Osterhout Library, obviously a historical building, very beautiful. And so we played in front of their little fireplace area, and a lot of people attended, and it was really wonderful.
And then the Titanic Library, we had a similar experience actually with the middle school students. We had a number of senior citizens that came, and they asked some great questions as well. Very different questions than the middle schoolers, but also kept us on our toes.
One of the things we always recognize, and you mentioned, John, about your traveling and performing elsewhere. You also have studied elsewhere, perform elsewhere, and in these travels, you meet other musicians, and you sometimes get a sense that there's some good chemistry there. And because you have your own series, you're able then to invite them to come and play here as well. Is that the case with the opening of this season?
Yes, in a way. You know, thinking back to our very first concert, we did, we did duos, a trio, and a string quartet. And I think there were more people on stage than in the audience. But one of them was my father, so that doesn't count. And since then, we've obviously grown in our audience size. But I think when we started this, it was, you know, one of those situations where we didn't have a lot of funds to draw from. So it was just relying on friends that would want to come to obviously make great music and come and hang out. So this concert, our two guest artists, one of them is Henning Faut. He's a German pianist who's been living in the States for quite a while, though. We went to Eastman together. So that's how I know him. And we reconnected just, like I said, recently, playing several recitals together, two in Pennsylvania and two in West Virginia. And then the cellist is Theodor Buchholz, who I know from the Killington Music Festival, where I taught for many years. And he's been a dear friend of ours, and he's coming from Tucson, Arizona, where he's on the faculty at University of Arizona.
And that says something about their respect for you, because there's no need to get on a plane these days, especially when the lines are long, and to come and say, I'll play with you all because I want to.
And especially if you have to get a seat for your cello, too.
We forget about that, don't we? When you get a lineup like this, so at this point, do you say, ah, Brahms, ah, Bridge, ah, Kodály? How does that work, where you feel like we'd like to do the Brahms piano quartet, and then you think, well, who's available? What's the balance there?
It's kind of a mix of all of that. I think we kind of have pieces in mind that we want to do, and we have an idea of who we want to put together in an ensemble. Chamber music is a group effort. So there's always chemistry that you have to take into account. And certain people work better with others, and certain people are better at playing certain pieces together. And so all of these factors you kind of have to think about and then bring it all together into a program.
For this program, though, I think it was the Brahms was really the centerpiece. We actually had programmed this several years ago, but it wasn't on the main series. And so we really wanted to feature this piece prominently. And then from there, with the Brahms, and because the second piano quartet of Brahms is the longest, it's the most expansive of the three, and actually my favorite of the three. But because of that, it is a whole half a program by itself. So the Bridge is a nice piece in that, well, it's a beautiful piece of music, but it also is only one movement. And then the Kodály was a find by Amy, actually.
Yeah, I don't remember how I came across it. I think I was just listening to string trios, and I went down a YouTube rabbit hole and just kind of found it. And I loved it instantly because it starts with the cello pizzicato and then boom, bodo, boom, bodo. It's like, oh, what's going to happen? And it was very folksy, very Kodály. And apparently it was one of his very early pieces that he wrote after he had just begun collecting folk songs in his travels.
And we did want a string trio because, let's face it, the piano just has far more notes than the violin, viola, or cello does. So we wanted to make sure Henning had a chance to breathe in between the Bridge and the Brahms.
And that's a wonderful place to jump from when you talk about the folk feel of the Kodály, because the Bridge, before he got a little bit more adventurous, right?
Right.
The fantasy quartet has a little bit of the British folkiness, right?
Right. And I think maybe Bridge's music has fallen out of fashion somewhat, but with the exception, I think, of the fantasy quartet, it's still, I think, a staple of the piano quartet literature because it is, I think, very accessible. It's beautiful melodies, catchy themes.
Is it just a certain sense of rhythm that might suggest a folk flavor to the Bridge, or is there actually a quote?
I think in the Bridge, the rhythm is often actually quite ambiguous. It's in a compound meter. Most of it's in 9/8, but the theme, ba da da dum, kind of is a bit catchy. And then there is a middle section that is a bit more rhythmical. For me, though, I feel like the melody almost derives from the harmony of the work, rather than the other way around.
We certainly remember Brahms' Hungarian Dances, And he did have a folk influence in some of his works. Is that the case in this long piano quartet?
Last movement, it's very, very dance-like.
Not explicitly as in the first piano quartet, but there's certainly that Roma aspect of it.
If it's long and somewhat demanding in that sense, what turn out to be the satisfactions of a work like this by Brahms?
Well, it's not that the other piano quartets are short by any means. The other two are still well over 30 minutes, I think. Yeah, I think I read somewhere actually the second quartet was actually more popular in Brahms' lifetime, and that kind of changed in the 20th century, though, and the first one, I think, almost became the most popular of them. But as far as the length of it, I think it's exactly the right length that it needs to be, actually, for Brahms to say everything that it needs to say.
There is some sense, isn't there, that part of it, or at least in a movement of it, there's an orchestral feel?
Only there are parts that remind you of his first symphony, for sure.
And I think this was actually written around that time, maybe I think a little bit before. I mean, I think what's amazing about this piece is that, well, many things, but one is that he can make a piano quartet sound like a symphony sometimes, which is the fullness of the ensemble.
Yeah, I love the second movement where it's a little mysterious. You know, he has do-dum, bo-dum, that lilting kind of melody repeating over and over, but he develops it into this wash, you know, like an explosion of emotion.
Which is, at least for me, is one of the most beautiful movements he ever wrote.
And I always like to ask you about you and Brahms and the viola, how he uses the instrument in this work.
I mean, Brahms, he always knows how to write for viola. He doesn't treat the viola like just a filler. He always features the instrument in the best register and gives it nice juicy melodies. And he's like a master weaver, I guess, of melodies and harmonies. And it's always very satisfying to play as a violist.
I think just piano quartets in general, too. I personally love playing piano quartets. I think it's my favorite genre of chamber music in a way, just because, you know, a piano trio, it's like you have three soloists, and then a piano quintet, it's rather large, but the piano quartet, it allows each instrument to really shine. And I think Brahms, as Amy said, is the master of that.
And he was the pianist.
And in fact, he played the premiere of this piece.
Tell us about the spaces you'll be performing in, because I always like to know about chamber musicians in particular spaces and how they are congenial to what you're doing.
Well, the Friday concert will be at St. Stephen's in Wilkes-Barre. And obviously that's a church, so much boomier than our Saturday venue, which is at the Tractate Music Center in Williamsport. And that is it's a beautiful hall, but it's smaller and it's acoustically less boomy, but very nice acoustics. And the piano in there.
The piano is fantastic. I mean, it's a beautiful Steinway. It sounds like an orchestra in itself.
Are you ready to give us some samples?
Should we play some of the slow movement themes?
Sure.
One thing that's, I guess, I could point out that's special about it, you know, he calls for the strings to be muted in the beginning, so it dampens the sound and changes the color, and it stays that way for a good two-thirds of the movement until he asks us to take the mute off, and it becomes this, I don't know, like sunrise in a way, I think, of sound. But it starts off just very, I think, introspective, intimate.
Mm-hmm. At the end of the first movement, was it kind of bold?
It's in a very broad, I guess, ending. He doesn't end in this huge fortissimo chord. It's loud, but it's very expressive. and definitely not a final, I think, ending to the piece.
And how about some of the folky feeling in the finale? Is there any of that that
Sure.
you could share with us?
That's the start of it.
The opening movement?
The opening of it, people often associate it with a reference to Schubert, actually. And I can see that. And it's interesting, you know, the original, the melody. Right? It's nice on its own. But then to kind of create that orchestral sound, at least with the violin, he asks us to play two, sometimes three notes at the same time.
Certainly fills it out, doesn't it?
And makes you have to practice more. It's twice as hard.
Do you want to take us to the bridge?
Sure. So the bridge, like Amy said, it's with Brahms. It's somewhere like he weaves these melodies in and out. So without the entire ensemble, it doesn't quite make sense, but I can give you a snippet of perhaps one of the melodies that he does incorporate in here. It's that da-da-da-dum that repeats quite a bit in here.
And he also includes some chromatic chords in there that really reminds me of James Bond. There are some da-da-da kind of, hard to explain, very James Bondy.
The beginning and the end, it's very lush and lyrical, and like we said, it's like this woven tapestry. Then the middle is this very different texture, and it's a scherzo, actually. And then maybe we could play that melody, pium, pium, pa, pa, pum, after five.
Yeah.
There I am.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. And it's about, what, 13, 14 minutes? It's not a long piece.
Correct, yeah.
That's nice. And is there any of the folky business Kodai? Of the Kodai that you might give us a sense of the flavor?
Sure.
Which is actually, it trades off, starts with the violin, then the viola has it.
Yes, just what you were singing before. Give us the dates and times.
So Friday, November 7 at 7 p.m. at St. Stephen's in Wilkes-Barre, and Saturday, November 8 at the Tracti Music Center in Williamsport.
Co-founders of the Northeastern Pennsylvania Chamber Music Society, violinist John Vida, executive director, violist Amy Iwazumi, chief of operations, and they've been speaking with us about concerts this weekend, two of them, Friday, November 7th at 7 at St. Stephen's Episcopal Pro Cathedral, 35 South Franklin Street in downtown Wilkes-Barre, and then Saturday, November 8th, also at 7, this time at Lycoming College in Williamsport, the Tracti Music Center, and that's at the Mary Lindsay Welsh Honors Hall, 304 East 4th Street. There will be the piano quartet in A major, it's number 2 by Johannes Brahms, the fantasy for piano quartet by Frank Bridge, and this intermezzo by Zoltán Kodály. That's Echoes and Interludes. That's the title of the concert program to be presented by the Northeastern Pennsylvania Chamber Music Society this weekend, Friday, November 7th at 7 at St. Stephen's Episcopal Pro-Cathedral, 35 South Franklin Street in downtown Wilkes-Barre. And again, Saturday, November 8th at 7 at Lycoming College in Williamsport, the Tracti Music Center, 304 East 4th Street. Brahms, Bridge, and Kodai. For more information on the web, nepacms.org, nepacms.org. That's Echoes and Interludes, nepacms.org.